Hello, everybody. Today, we're going to talk about food. Food, universal language we all speak, but sometimes, and in most of our cases, with a very American accent. Today, we're going to dive face first, fork first, to learn about that accent that we all speak and have and do with none other than David Page, the man who gave us a roadmap to America's most iconic eateries with diners, drive-ins, and dives, a seasoned journalist turned food television maestro. David is also the author of Food Americana, a deep dive into American food culture, trends, and what we can expect in our culinary future. From the ABC and NBC newsrooms to giving us the lowdown on everything from fast food to food treats, food trends, he's the voice you want to hear. And I love treats, David. It's going to be an amazing time with you today. I can't wait to talk about this, but for just one second, here we go. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to A Funny Way of Looking. I am Michael J. This is where diverse voices meet open minds. We're live every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday right here, or you can find us on afunnywayoflooking.com. It is it's an amazing site. Our team's been working on it really hard. I think you'll love it. David, how are you today? Welcome to the show.
I'm great. Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
Yeah. Can I just say that I'm talking to you about food. I'm starving because I haven't eaten yet, and I'm like ready to eat something. So we'll talk about it. I'll get even hungrier. And let's just dive in. Before we do that, though, I have to ask you the hardest question of the day, and that is, who do you want to do a shout out to?
Al Buck, who was a legend, is still with us, thank God. He's 83, I think. A legendary news executive in the TV business who taught me a whole lot about everything. And so, hi, Al.
There you go. Hey, Al, how are you doing? He can't answer. Well, actually, he could if he said something in the comments.
I should have warned him.
Yeah, we should have. Let's do some fun questions today. I want to start with, what is American food?
American cuisine, as I defined it in my book, Food Americana, is similar to the immigration patterns that have created our multicultural society, is a group of foods that came to the United States originally with an immigrant group, or that were indigenous to the people who were here when settlers found them, and that then over the years were modified, often very significantly, to American tastes, the availability of American ingredients, and evolved over time from that. So I believe Chinese food is American. I'm not talking about Chinese food as eaten in China. I'm talking about Chinese food as it evolved in America after initially being brought here from the Canton province of China by folks who came to feed the Chinese gold miners who came to California during the gold rush in the 1800s. I'm talking about sushi being an American food. Generally not the sushi that's eaten in Japan, but the sushi that evolved from that beginning in the mid-60s, when Japanese restaurants serving Japanese businessmen began to proliferate in California. The food was then sampled by and picked up by many of the beautiful people, many of the celebrities, especially in the very beginning, Yul Brynner. And then over time, the concept of sushi as raw fish, even though it doesn't have to include raw fish, was unappealing to most Americans, so sushi evolved. You got the California roll, which has no raw fish in it. It has imitation crab and replicating the fat of fatty tuna, you have avocado. Mexican food evolved the same way. Pizza evolved the same way. These are foods that started someplace else, that came here and then were changed substantially over time and together form our cuisine. Now, I'm including as American food only the foods that are common everywhere in the country and that are part of everyday conversations about what should we have for lunch today, which is why I'm including sushi and not Thai food. Thai food is very popular in many places, but it's not a universal go-to. It's why I'm including sushi, but not Peruvian food, despite the fact that advocates of Peruvian food have been pushing for us to eat more of it forever. And it's really, really good. But at least in the form as eaten in Peru, where the iconic dish is something called anticuchos, which is grilled beef heart, Americans are not stepping up to the plate and saying, I got to have me some of that.
You realize you're like blowing my mind here. Right.
Okay. Good.
Like, what is the difference? Okay. Because I have not been to Japan. I have not been to China. Mm-hmm. What is the difference between, I don't even know if they call it a sushi roll or any kind of roll in Japan. What's the difference between us and Japan?
Yeah. The proliferation of sushi rolls is mostly what Americanized sushi consists of. And we are making sushi rolls with a variety of ingredients that never would have been used in Japan. There's a place I know of that puts a pork chop in a sushi roll. They're treating it differently than it's generally treated in Japan. There's a sushi bar inside a gas station across from an airbase outside Oklahoma City. Now, Oklahoma being, you know, the kind of the capital of the chicken fried steak. Mm-hmm. So sushi rolls are dropped whole into the deep fryer. You don't see that in Japan. You got the Philadelphia roll that has smoked salmon in it and cream cheese. Cream cheese is an item that's never been part of any Asian cuisine. And you have a variety of spicy sauces that you generally won't get on a sushi roll in Japan. And just the size. Basically, our sushi rolls are supersized compared to what you'd find in Japan.
Oh my gosh. Okay. It's still mind blown. And
yeah, but it's everyday food. I mean, I spoke to a high-ranking executive at one of the largest prepared sushi companies in the country, who said to me, look, when I was a kid, my friends and I would go out for lunch. It was burgers and fries. When my kids go out for lunch, it's sushi. You can get it everywhere. I mean, you can get it at the drugstore. it's pretty ubiquitous.
Okay, so I have to ask this question then. You've defined it as things that we can find and they're ubiquitous in mm-hmm. the U.S. Mm-hmm. If we go to another country, if I go to mm-hmm. Japan and someone says, what is American food? What is something that you would say is iconic American food? And you got to have this when you get to Chicago or New York or L.A. or Dallas or Memphis or whatever. What is American food to people who are not from America?
Well, OK, that means ignore everything that came here from their cultures and got modified. You're talking about barbecue. You're talking about lobster rolls. Not a lot more. I mean, those are pretty much the two items that to some extent are endemic here or intrinsic here. Although I just read an article. It's interesting. There is and has for a long time, the accepted belief of the evolution of barbecue was that it first started in the Caribbean as something called barbacoa. Now, that's the Spanish translation of a Taino word, which basically meant a platform made of sticks. And barbecue initially was apparently cooked on a platform made of sticks over coals. There's an argument being made by another author that, in fact, while that existed and was parallel, it really was not part of the evolution of barbecue in America. To me, that difference is pretty minor, as whether you take the sticks from the Caribbean or not, barbecue for the most part was created in America by enslaved people using techniques and flavors that they knew from West Africa.
Okay, so when I go to Korean barbecue and Mongolian barbecue, Is that a
meat? Well, those are, just because the word in English is barbecue doesn't mean it's what we would have known as barbecue. Those, I can't speak to Mongolian because I'm not sure of the cooking style, but Korean barbecue is meat in close proximity to coals, direct fire, which I think kind of came up its own way in Korea. That's different than what the initial concept of American barbecue was, which is a whole carcass cooked low and slow over heat that was quite some distance from the animal, taken to its extreme in Texas, where it's offset cooking and no piece of meat is directly over fire. It's possible for similar kinds of food to be created independently in different cultures.
Gotcha. So we got barbecue. That one's uniquely American. I want to talk about the American diet. And basically, like, we have, it seems, at least I've read, that we eat a lot more bigger portions than other places around the planet. And we now are worried about, you know, eating healthy, right? How did that come about? Why is it come about? Is it a marketing thing? It is a we want to eat like other countries thing? What is the whole?
It's a combination of factors. I would place much of the initial blame on the euphoria in this country that followed World War II. For white Americans, white middle-class Americans, minorities were excluded. They were excluded in the law. I mean, if you're black, you didn't qualify for GI Bill benefits or a VA loan. But for white middle-class America after World War II, it was a time of massive expansion and growth and a sense that anything was possible. More became better. Now, it didn't start just there. I mean, the fact is, when poor Italian immigrants came from southern Italy to the United States in the 1800s, they found that being poor here was different than being poor there. In southern Italy, being poor meant you never had meat. Here, it meant, yeah, you could have meat, not as much and not as good a cut as a wealthier person, but you could have meat, which created what we came to know in red sauce restaurants as abbondanza, sauces that previously were just tomato, all of a sudden were filled with meat because it was possible to do that. Portions got larger, meatballs got larger. And we have continued as a culture down that path of more is better. I mean, we did invent the McMansion. As to the content of the food, I just read a very interesting article the other day that placed much of our, I would say, addiction with fast food, i.e. filled with salt, sugar, and fat, on the purchase of fast food companies by tobacco companies, I think in the 70s, I have to go back and read the article, and they approached the marketing the same way they approached marketing cigarettes to get people involved in desiring something that isn't really good for you. The fact of the matter is, salt, sugar, and fat are if not medically, and perhaps medically, but certainly psychologically addictive. And the more you give us that, the more we want that.
I will attest to wanting more sugar as a sugar addict. I understand that. So that is an eye-opening revelation that you just made about, is that really, where can we find more about that? About the
I've got the article somewhere. You want me to look it up? Well, let's see. Hold on. Where is
it? You know what? We're going to do a another article on you, by the way, on a fun way of looking at news.
Thank you.
And
here we go.
The link in there.
It's a Washington Post article.
Okay.
From the 9th of 2019. It's an old article. Look at that. New study suggests that tobacco companies who were skilled at marketing cigarettes used similar strategies to hook people on processed foods. Tell you what, wow. I mean, I'll just put that in your chat so you can have it.
Okay.
There you go.
We've got several people watching right now. I just want to know if anyone else is like shocked by this or are new that.
I'm Why would you be shocked by anything done by a tobacco company after their CEOs all perjured themselves in front of Congress?
I'm going to drop that into the comments so that people can actually check it out themselves right now, which is pretty awesome. Thank you for that.
It's okay. Allow me to wipe the juice that's dripping down my mustache. There we go.
Yeah. What do you think about trends in food? What's going on right now? What's good? What's the thing that's happening right now that everyone's like,
it's a very, it's an unsettled time. It's hard to tell. I mean, there's a lot of talk about eating healthy, but what does that really mean? Does it mean eating a grain-only burger because somehow that's better for us than beef, when in fact it's one of the most highly processed food products you'll ever come across, and no one has studied the carbon footprint impact of producing that burger? There's a lot of lip service toward eating real food, which has allowed people to make a lot of money selling food kits to people when, good God, you don't need to open a pre-measured package of salt to put with pre-measured pieces of chicken. It takes you twice as long to do that as it does to cook something for real. You want to cook a chicken? Get a pan. Put a chicken in it. Rub it with salt, pepper, and garlic. Add a little stock so it doesn't dry out. Uh-huh. Turn your oven up to 500. Put the chicken in there. Take it out 40 minutes later and have dinner.
Did you just say 500?
I cook a lot of things at 500.
Okay. Broil or bake?
Bake. Okay. But interestingly enough, I recently adopted a different technique for cooking steak, which is the reverse sear. Most people cook steak by getting the pan as hot as possible, throwing the steak on, waiting till you got a sear on one side, turning it over, wait till you get a sear on the other side. Mm-hmm. And what you end up doing in the process is turning much of the exterior shell of that steak into well-done meat. You have much less meat in the center that is pink. However, if you go with the reverse sear, what you do is you put the steak in the oven at low temperature. I choose 270. And you let it cook slowly so that it cooks evenly at a low temperature. And when it's pink all the way across, you take it out, throw it in a really hot pan on top of the stove for a minute on one side, a minute on the other side, and you got the best steak you ever ate outside of a steakhouse.
Okay. Okay. What are you into the putting the butter and salt and everything onto the on steak or no?
No, I mean, if you do it in a steakhouse, that's fine. I don't find it necessary. What I do, the thing I focus on is if I'm eating steak as steak, as mm-hmm. opposed to steak salad or some other steak as one of many ingredients, it's very important to me to buy a really good piece of meat. And I got to tell you, you need a butcher. With all due respect to the butcher areas of supermarkets, you wouldn't buy a car from a drapery salesman. So go to a butcher. First of all, it's a wonderful experience. You can go into a butcher and say, I'm thinking about doing this. What cut should I use? I mean, my wife likes steak tartare, not every day, but, and I won't, under no circumstances will I get steak tartare that hasn't been freshly ground in front of me because, or while I'm waiting. Because hamburger meat can become, in fact, it's the wrong word, but can contain E. coli when at the industrial level, pieces of meat are ground up often from various different places and there's been a contaminant on the outside. Anyway, I went to my butcher and I said, my wife wants some steak tartare tonight. What do you recommend? He said, you'll be surprised by this, because you think there's a low fat content, but I would suggest flank steak. So I said, great, grind me a pound of flank steak. And I don't particularly like steak tartare, but my wife loved it. You know, I go to that butcher, I say, give me two nice New York strips. I take them home, and they're like, you know, they're $25 a pound. But since it's a steak dinner, which in a restaurant would cost me $85 a steak, mm-hmm. I consider, you know, once a week, that's worth it. I take that good piece of meat home and I treat it well.
Nice, nice. What's your favorite? Your favorite cut of steak, of beef? What is your favorite?
This will surprise you. For me, it's a New York strip. Now, people will tell you that the ribeye is better. Some people prefer the filet mignon, although if I'm going to eat that cut of meat, I want to eat it as a big piece of tenderloin because I think it's much, much tastier that way. But yeah, okay. I'm a New York strip guy.
Okay. I keep going back to your statement at the beginning about all of these foods that become Americanized food. Mm-hmm. I think of steak like as one of those things. You go like steak, that's an American dish, you know?
Well, to some extent it is. I mean, look, the concept of the beefsteak per se, beef came, or our love for beef came from the English who settled this country to a great extent. And cuts of steak are different here than in the rest of the world. But look, the French have steak frites. They like hanger steak. The Brits have entrecote. So I can't say that the concept of cooking a cut of beef is particularly American on its face. We have become, I think, the world's greatest steak lovers. Again, partially during the go-go years, if you will, I think it was a way of showing off. I can afford uh-huh. steak. And, you know, yeah, there's a lot of steak in America. I didn't do steak or beef per se in the book because I focused on the meat product that is so quintessentially American. There's an argument to be made that I could have done a chapter on steak or at least yep. beef in the broader sense, mm-hmm. you know, chops, roasts.
Okay. I get on board with that. Let's talk about something that, and I don't know if it's going to blow up in the comments or not. Pizza.
Yes. Okay.
Like pizza is a staple. If you don't want to cook, mm-hmm. you just grab a pizza, frozen pizza, order pizza, go out
for pizza. Frozen pizza, please.
Go for it. Talk about some pizza, because that seems to me, even though one says Italian, I'm thinking pizza American. What do you think?
Well, I think pizza in some respects is the ultimate American food. Mm-hmm. It came here from Southern Italy. When it came here, in Southern Italy, among the poor, it was simply dough with some tomato on it. If you had a really good week, maybe you could afford to top it with a piece of lard or a sardine. Mm-hmm. But it was the lowest of the low. When the immigrants arrived here, they found a number of things. Number one, they could not replicate the pizza they made at home for a number of reasons. The wheat in the United States has a different protein content than the wheat in Italy. The ovens that they found in New York were fueled by coal. The pizza ovens in Italy were fueled by wood. So you ended up with a pizza with a different crust texture to start with. Then in terms of availability of ingredients, as I said earlier, this was a population that realized they could afford some meat. They could afford some other things. So the concept of topping a pizza, the gates opened and it was abbondanza time. But what's interesting to pizza, I talked about how food evolves. Food evolves in many, many ways. I mean, in most countries, food is regional. It's based on what grew in that area or what the economic conditions would allow in that area. In the United States, we have a lot of regions that pizza began to travel to as the Italian population moved across the country. And what happened there was that pizza, regional styles of pizza developed based on what was regionally available. Okay. There's pizza in St. Louis, I guess, that's made with something called Provel cheese. That is a processed cheese combination that involves Swiss and others, and liquid smoke. There's the Chicago deep dish pizza that developed there alongside, by the way, one of the great pizzas in America, which is the thin crust Chicago bar pie that fewer people may be familiar with. I mean, all in all, you got 30, at least 30 styles of pizza in the United States today. There's a kind of pizza called Old Forge that began in a Pennsylvania coal mining town called Old Forge, Pennsylvania, that was invented to feed hungry miners by a bar owner. And is highly unique. It's oblong. It comes in two varieties, red or white. Red has the sauce on top of the cheese, I believe. The white has a flavor to it, almost like caraway. These are unique pizzas, only known in that section of Pennsylvania. And so popular that when you enter Old Forge, there's a sign that denotes it as the pizza capital of America, which, of course, you know, you can call yourself, I'm the David Page capital of the Jersey Shore. You know, you can say what you want, but and by the way, it's available on Gold Belly, and it's terrific. Not to push Gold Belly and their ridiculous prices, but there's the most recent pizza to be discovered is Detroit style, which was invented in the 40s by a bar owner in Detroit who baked them in these blue steel metal pans that had been liberated from an auto supply shop or an auto factory, because it was Detroit. And that has this wonderful rim of caramelized cheese around the sides. And in the last few years, what happened was a gentleman, and I'm embarrassed to say I'm going to forget his name. He was a great guy. He passed away not that long ago from brain cancer. But Sean something. Anyway, he made Detroit pizza in Detroit, and he took it to the World Pizza Championships in Vegas, and he won. And that's what put Detroit pizza on the map, to the degree that Pizza Hut or Domino's or maybe both put it on the menu for a while.
Wow. I am going to kick off the pizza debate here. This may be my Facebook question of the day, and that is, we'll go with the pedestrian pizzas that everyone knows. We got deep dish and thin crust, and you can be the first one to respond. Which one do you like?
Deep dish is not pizza, it's a casserole.
Okay, there you go. Chicago people, chime in.
No, it's not. By the way, deep dish pizza is, on a given day, a wonderful thing to eat. I just don't consider it a pizza because pizza has topping, not filling. It's my own opinion. Now, the best pizza of all is margarita.
I like margarita.
But you're probably not eating it the way it is eaten in Italy, where it's much soupier with a much less crunchy crust than it's made here. And Tony Geminiani, one of the world's greatest pizza makers, who runs a number of pizza restaurants in San Francisco and allowed me to audit his pizza school there for the book, Tony says it has a half-life of like a nanosecond. It doesn't deliver well. He says if he brings it to a table where people are talking and the pizza sits there uneaten for a minute, 2 minutes, he takes it away and brings them another one. Because it doesn't hold up.
There we go. We got two people weighing in already, so it's 50-50. We got thin crust. We got deep dish. Doing the Chicago thing, I'm like all into the deep dish myself. Casserole.
Okay, you guys, look. It's awesome. My wife and many friends enjoy green bean casserole made with mushroom soup at Thanksgiving.
Yes,
I tried to make it for my wife once with real onions and fresh green beans, and she rejected it. People like casseroles. We lived in Minnesota for 10 years where they don't call it casserole, they call it deep dish, but they put everything in a a pan with mushroom soup, and they throw tater tots or potato chips on top, and they call it a meal. You know, things happen.
We're going to play this or that in a second, but I just got to ask, where do you see food going in the U.S.?
Haven't got a clue. Mm-hmm. I haven't got a clue. Every prediction is wrong. You know, at one point it was going to be all non-meat meat. That's not working. At one point, and we're all going to go.
Wait, the non-meat meat? You're saying Beyond Meat and the Impossible?
Yeah, all of that. That the meat industry was going to be shell-shocked by public acceptance of faux meat.
Okay.
Yeah, the people who are going to eat it are eating it. I don't see it storming the ramparts of anything, frankly. Part of my mantra is, if you're going to eat well, and we have a lot of work to do to eradicate factory farming and to reduce methane release into the atmosphere. But I don't see fake pizza sausage really contributing much to that. There was a piece, I think, in the New York Times this week, maybe the Wall Street Journal, about the difficulties that companies are having producing meat from the cellular level. They went into great detail about a couple of companies that are growing chicken from cells.
Yes.
Too many people are going to find that icky. And it is apparently quite expensive. And it's very hard, since you're not really sure which cells you started with, it's hard to tell if you're getting white meat or dark or both. Mm-hmm. I do think there will continue to be a broadening of American interest in foods from other places, perhaps in some cases to a big enough or great enough degree that I would consider them part of American cuisine. Right now, I see a lot happening in the area of what is not American cuisine, of trying foods as currently made in their historical countries of origin. Yeah. Chinese food as eaten in China is becoming more available, for example. For many years now, Italian-American food has been broadening beyond red sauce, you know, often simplistically referred to as the difference between Northern Italian and Southern Italian, which isn't true. But, you know, Italy is made of regions with different kinds of food. Mexican food, there is an increasing interest in Mexican foods that were not traditionally part of Mexican-American, which grew out of the foods of the northern border with Mexico, and all of the inhabitants there who suddenly found themselves American one day after the Mexican-American War. More foods from other parts of Mexico are becoming popular. There's something called birria, which is a spicy meat stew that's just fantastic. Birria tacos, or with cheese, quesadilla tacos, are just extraordinary. There's you take a tortilla, you dip it in the sauce that the beef was cooked in. It's usually beef. In central Mexico, it started out as goat, but by the time it got here, it's mostly beef. You dip the taco in the sauce, you put it on a flat top. You take the meat out, you put it on the taco, on the tortilla. You add the cheese. You fold it over, let it crisp. Then you pour more of the sauce on it, turn it over, let it crisp, and serve it with a cup full of that cooking liquid, which now that you're eating it will be called consomme. And you dip the taco into the consomme. It's extraordinary.
Extraordinary. You realize I'm starving right now. So
sorry, dude.
Yeah, I don't know where I can go.
Doing what I can. I'm trying to help.
You're helping me be more hungry is what you're doing. I love that.
But it's good for you food. There's nothing in that dish that's bad for you. It's the sauce is meat and peppers, a variety of peppers. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's sugar. The tortilla, I'm trying to think, since it came from central Mexico, it's probably a corn tortilla. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Flour tortillas, which a lot of Americans want to criticize as not being authentic, actually were the standard in northern Mexico after missionaries got up to that area, Spanish missionaries, and planted flour, wheat. But I think it's a corn tortilla. I have to think twice. It's a fantastic. It's like mole. Mole, you know, was born around Puebla and has migrated to the United States. There's a restaurant on Long Beach Island, New Jersey, here on the shore, that I included in my book, where the family that owns the place makes mole the way his mother-in-law, her mom, did in Puebla. And it's absolutely extraordinary. It's just phenomenal.
You know, I got to ask you one last question before we play this or that. And okay. It's a shout out to Rachel, who's on my team. And she has been telling me about Filipino food and she's got recommendations. What's your take on Filipino food? That would not be American yet, right?
This is going to be a terrible answer. I don't know. I don't know it. It's so rare to find Filipino food in most of the country. It's certainly not American cuisine. I'm guessing it's damn fine, but I have no experience with it. I'm sorry.
I don't either. And she has been saying, Michael, you got to try. I cannot remember any of the dishes except for halo halo, which is a dessert. And I definitely am going to try that. And then we'll share some stories once I get out to the restaurant and try it. But in the meantime, we are going to play a game of this or that. I'm going to give you two choices. You can pick one or the other, but not neither or both. And if you want to explain your pick, you can do that. I think we're going to start pretty easy, pretty pedestrian. I don't know if this is going to be offensive to your taste buds or what, but we'll see as we go. Start easy. We'll get a little more complex as we go on and just see how David Page answers some questions.
Okay.
First one, burgers or hot dogs?
Burgers.
Yeah. Where's your favorite burger, by the way?
My kitchen.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I can't do one. So French fries or onion rings?
Fries.
Okay. Ketchup or mustard?
Ketchup.
Do you put mustard and ketchup on hot dogs or not?
Mustard, no ketchup. Hot dogs don't get ketchup.
What about relish?
Relish is good. Yeah, no. I lived in Chicago for a couple of years. I'm all in on the overloaded Chicago dog.
Absolutely. Go hit one at Portillo's and you're all good.
Oh, yeah.
How about pancakes or waffles?
Pancakes.
Okay.
But not the first one.
What do you mean the first?
The first pancake that you make is always.
Oh, right. The first one.
A mutant. Yeah. That, there's a museum of first pancakes somewhere.
I understand that. By the way, do you like the little dollar size ones or like the ones that fill up the whole plate?
I like the big ones.
Absolutely.
I like the big ones. Yeah. There's the ratio of edge to center is way off on silver dollar pancakes.
How about.
Now, hold on.
Okay.
With one exception. If you think a blini is a pancake, then my favorite is a blini with caviar. But that's for you to determine.
Yeah, I don't even know what you're talking about there.
Blini's little buck.
No, I know what blini is, but blini with caviar. And yeah, I'm still just pancake maple syrup.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, corn syrup works too. The corn syrup maple syrup mixture is kind of
okay. I grew up in Western Massachusetts. It's got to be maple.
Straight from the
sugar in the house. In fact, there's a dish in New England you may never have heard of called sugar on snow. Do you know what that is?
No.
In the old days, it was really snow. But now if you go eat at a sugar in house that has a restaurant, they bring you a pie plate full of crushed ice and a hot pitcher of maple syrup, presumably at one time straight from the production process, but now they heat it up. They pour that on the snow, the ice. The maple syrup freezes into a candy, and it's so sweet that it is served with pickles.
Wow.
It's phenomenal.
By the way, I will say that one of my go-tos with that sweet, sour, salty, sweet thing is I love ice cream with French fries.
I'm sorry, I have to leave now. It's that. Oh.
I mean, I won't put the ice cream on the French fries. Like,
oh, you know, man. That's just that's inexplicably horrible.
That's one of my favorite things ever.
You're destroying two iconic foods at once.
Oh my gosh. Now being from having lived in Chicago, I love these, but food truck or fine dining?
On a daily basis, food truck.
Yeah. There are some amazing food trucks out there. People just don't know.
See, remember, food trucks are also, because of the economics, a way for an unfamiliar cuisine to grab a foothold and become available.
Mm-hmm.
It's much easier to start a food truck than a bricks and mortar restaurant. So the availability of a wide variety of foods is best represented in a food truck situation.
Absolutely. And you can test to see what people like before you start the restaurant if you want to. How about soul food or Tex-Mex?
You're asking a white Jew about soul food?
I'm just saying.
Okay, I'm extremely fond of soul food, but I would go with Tex-Mex.
Okay. We've got, by the way, Renee in the comments has written a question that it's going to be the last question I ask you for the day.
Okay.
I just have to hear this, but we're going to continue with some this or that right now. Two popular dishes or things that have come up, bagel with cream cheese or avocado toast?
Oh, God. Didn't I just mention that I'm a New York Jew? Come on.
So bagel with cream cheese, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Well, bagel with cream cheese on lox.
Oh yeah,
with lox. Yeah, you gotta have the lox.
What's your favorite bagel, by the way?
Depends. If I'm eating smoked salmon, which has a low salt content, I'll go for an everything bagel.
Yes.
If I'm eating belly lox, which was the first lox, which was brined in salt and is heavily salty, then I'll go for a plain or a poppy seed bagel because you can't have that much salt on top of the lox.
Okay. There we go. You know, one thing we did not talk about was any kind of drinks. So we'll start with this one. How about craft beer or classic soda?
Classic soda. Classic Even soda. Though I've done a whole syndicated series on craft beer.
Yeah. But I got you. I soda.
But again, my soda choice, man, this whole part of the podcast has become so Jewish centric. My favorite soda would be Dr. Brown's Sel Ray.
Where do you get that?
You get it in any deli. It's literally similar to ginger ale with ginger. It's literally a soda made of celery, and it's fantastic. And if you have a pastrami on rye with mustard and you don't have a Sel Ray soda, your back breaks.
Dang, okay. I've got to change up some things I'm eating. I already know what you're going to say on this, but I'll ask it anyway, just for the crowd. Impossible Burger or grass-fed beef?
Beef, of course.
Of course. Ceviche or sashimi?
Ceviche.
Okay. Do you make your own?
Yes, I do. Although the best, see, it's so funny where you can find great meals. The best ceviche I ever had was made at the little poolside restaurant at a condominium complex in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, where we vacationed a few times. How this, I mean, yes, the fish is incredibly fresh in Puerto Vallarta, but for this dish to come out the best I've ever had from some guy serving kind of, you know, everyday meals by the pool blew me away.
Okay, I gotcha. Let's go a little more thought-provoking. Let's talk about the future of food. How about vertical farming or lab-grown meat? What's going to happen, you think?
Define vertical farming as you see it.
Okay, I see one of those things I can put on my porch and I can hang vegetables and...
Well, I don't think either of those concepts are going to be mainstream, but I'd go with vertical farming.
Okay. I think vertical farm. We'll see if Elon takes either of those like to Mars when he gets his ships ready to go.
Yeah.
That'll be an interesting thing. Talk about local artisan cheese versus mass-produced cheese just for a second. I'm sure you're going to say local artisan.
I'm going to say local artisan, but I'm not even going to say local artisan. I'm going to say good cheese as opposed to the processed crap that is routinely sold to people as if it's cheese. I mean, let's take the carbon footprint out of it. Let's ignore the fact that to get a blue cheese from Rogue Farms in Oregon, it has to be flown across the country. It's an extraordinary cheese. You should enjoy it. This is one of the food items that America no longer understands what's good. I mean, cheese is a wonderful thing. Okay. There are a million kinds of cheese. You can do anything with cheese. It's an incredible source of protein. It's an incredible source of flavor. And good cheese is a special thing. The crap that comes in plastic packaging that you buy next to the cream cheese display in your supermarket, for the most part, is disgusting. Okay. The only plastic-wrapped cheese that I would intentionally buy, because it's a unique item, perfectly suited to a unique task, is processed yellow American cheese, because over time it has proven to be the perfect companion on a cheeseburger.
Yeah, yeah, it has. Yeah. I'm going to go with that. And there's no bad words coming out of my mouth about the Kraft singles or whatever you want to call them. Grandma's missed recipes or Michelin, you know, 1, 2, and 3 stars?
Oh, Grandma.
Yeah.
Michelin, look, most Michelin chefs are attempting to elevate what was a grandma's recipe in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I'd much rather go with everyone's grandma's cooking. It's real. It's terrific. Sometimes it's not. My grandmother used to make something she called Jewish spaghetti, which is a perfect encapsulation of the immigrant experience here. A Jewish woman who escaped the Nazis making spaghetti because she thought it was an American dish, but doing it by frying it in a pan with onions and ketchup.
I've had some of this fried spaghetti, and I can't say too much bad about it. I'm on it.
Okay, there you go, dude.
I'm on it. Last question. I'm going to leave this. Renee told me she's going to watch this show because she was waiting to hear what you had to say. Her question to you is, David, if you had one last meal, what would it be?
Depends how I'm feeling on the day, but let's assume I'm on death row. It's either brisket and sausage from Louis Miller's Barbecue in Taylor, Texas, or it's lox bagels and cream cheese from Russ and Daughters on the Lower East Side of New York.
Dang, I think that answers that question pretty well right there. So thank you for that. Renee, I hope that answers your question. And by the way, Renee is going to find another amazing place for us to go eat in Dallas sometime. So I'm waiting for that to happen.
It's a deal.
Okay. Thank you for being on the show. This has been really, really fun, and I've learned a lot. I've had my mind blown, and I want people to be able to get you and get your books and follow you. They can find you on, I'm going to say this for the people who are on podcast and can't see the screen, David is on linkedin.com/in/david-page-65b6728. That's 65b6728, and that's because David did not change and claim his own URL, but that's what it is right now. He's also over on Facebook at david.page.1840. We're going to get you an assistant, like just to change your names for you.
Okay.
Okay. And over on Twitter, which is now X at Page Prod, Page P-R-O-D, and Page is P-A-G-E, Page Prod. Instagram, Food Americana. And you can find them at all those cool places. I'm going to leave that up for just a second. You can also find us on afunnywayoflooking.com. We're going to have David's interview up there. We'll have all kinds of, we're going to have an article that we're going to write about David and throw up there. You'll be able to find some of the things he's talked about, hopefully some of the recipes he's mentioned, this whole steak on the
reverse sear.
Reverse sear.
Hey, can I throw in one more pitch?
Please do.
Go to Amazon.com and buy my book, Food Americana.
You got it right there. Do you have it? You can hold it up and show.
I got it somewhere. Here we go.
Let's take a look at the book and see what
Hamburger America, which I had out for some reason.
I love that. Hold it right in front of your face. It'll show up better. Right there. That's good. Food Americana by David Page, P-A-G-E. And pop over to Amazon and check it out. Thank you for being here again. Absolutely love that. You guys check us out at A Funny Way of Looking. And
Michael, let me interrupt and just say it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've been amazing. I've got some new food things to try out. Thank you for that.
Good.
All right, everybody. See you next time.